Hello, and welcome back to the Battle of Agincourt podcast. Today, I am particularly excited, as this episode, we will be looking at the reign of one of England's most iconic kings, Edward III, also called the Battle King. This episode will span the 1300s, where the much-prefaced Hundred Years' War took place. I don't think any further introduction is necessary, so I will get started. As you know, Edward III was the son of Edward II, go figure, the weak ruler who was deposed by his wife and her lover, Baron Mortimer. At the time of Edward II's deposition, it was decided by Parliament that he would be imprisoned and that when his son Edward III came of age, he would inherit the throne. But in the meantime, his mother, Queen Isabella, and Roger Mortimer would act as regents, effectively having the rule of England all to themselves. No doubt they thought that, with the prince being in his minority, that they would have ample time to influence and manipulate him, so that after he came of age, they could rule through him. They would be in for a rude awakening, though. When Edward II was formally deposed, his son Edward III was only 14 years old. His mother and Roger Mortimer would insist that young Edward marry Philippa. Now, Philippa was the daughter of the Count of Hainaut, who was the French lord who had assisted them in their invasion to overthrow Edward II. We're not sure if young Edward wanted this marriage or not. However, this is irrelevant, for regardless of the young king's desires, for the time being, his mother and her lover were in control. Isabella and Roger Mortimer went into a frenzy after the depossession of Edward II, stamping out any perceived threat to their new regime. They hoarded wealth, replaced officials whom they disliked, and Mortimer even created a new title for himself, the Earlship of March, which gave him governance over a large estate near the northwestern border with Wales, called the Welsh Marches. The barons whom had initially supported Isabella and Mortimer now found that they somewhat regretted this development. The new regime threatened to be just as corrupt as the previous, and so two of England's most powerful lords, the Earls of Kent, which is in southeastern England, and the Earl of Lancaster, who is uncle to the king, rose in rebellion. However, this would fail, resulting in the beheading of the Earl of Lancaster in the year 1330 on charge of high treason. The social atmosphere was tense and gloomy. Isabella and Mortimer were so paranoid and suspicious of plots that even the more enjoyable aspects of noble and common life were now prohibited, such as jousting, tournaments of any kind, whether it was archery, melee, or even football. During this time, the new Earl of Lancaster, Henry, who was the son of the executed Thomas, seethed over what he considered the murder of his father by a pretender, this Roger Mortimer, whom behaved as if he was now King of England. Henry Lancaster reached out to his father's co-conspirators during his brief rebellion, who were able to remain unfound out. These men were Richard de Bury and William Montague. The three lords resolved to overthrow Mortimer and Isabella, deciding to take this enormous gamble. They decided to reach out to the 16-year-old Edward III. Now, this could have gone south very quickly for the three lords. After all, Edward had joined Mortimer and Isabella when they went to France years before and refused to return. In addition, when Edward II tried to convince at least his son, young Edward III, to return, the boy did not. As such, for all they knew, Edward III supported his mother and her lover's regime. However, this would not be the case. It turns out that young Edward was tormented by his betrayal, by the betrayal of his father. He certainly had to admit that his father, Edward II, was a poor ruler, and his deposition was good for the realm. However, blood does run thick, and by all accounts, Edward II was good to his children. Furthermore, it was whispered that Edward II's death had been not from sickness, as was the official report, but murder at the hands of Mortimer himself. Edward III, no doubt, would have heard this and been enraged at the fact that, the murderer of his father was now not only sleeping with his mother, but ruling England in all but name. The gamble worked, and so young Edward joined the three lords in the conspiracy. They sent a secret appeal to the Pope, and you'll remember from the Heretics and Plagues episode that we discussed how important it was to have the Pope's blessing in some enterprise, as it was seen by many, even foreign kings, as a legitimizing decree. The Pope approved of their plan, and so, in November 1330, under cover of darkness, Edward, Henry Lancaster, Richard de Bury, and William Montague, and a force of mounted knights and retainers, departed from London. Secrecy was paramount, as had his mother heard of Edward's departure, she would no doubt have understood his intent and moved to intercept him. Spies of the conspirators had confirmed Roger Mortimer's location. He was in Nottingham. The young king and his companions made all speed for the city, and following their spies' reconnaissance, located Mortimer. They ambushed the house, slaying his personal guard in sudden, bitter violence, and dragged the surprised Earl Mortimer out to face the now 17-year-old King of England. Sources say that Edward drew his sword and desired to kill Mortimer there and then. However, Henry Lancaster stayed his hand. Lancaster argued that, in order to show the realm the kind of king Edward desired to be, he had to veer away from the clandestine killings that define Mortimer and his mother's regime. Mortimer would be put on trial before Parliament. Now, we can't start thinking for a minute that this was going to be a fair trial. In this, we can be cynical, as the trial was ultimately, and you know, everyone involved knew this, it was ultimately, for sure, just for the appearance of legitimacy. Number one, Mortimer was not allowed to speak in his own defense. In fact, he was dragged before Parliament bound in chains with a gag stuffed in his mouth. Among his charges were the murder of Edward II, amassing royal funds for personal enrichment, and assuming the powers of the King of England. The Parliament condemned Roger Mortimer as guilty, and his execution was dated to be a month later. He was taken from the Tower of London and dragged behind two horses to Tyburn. He was forced to wear the black tunic he had worn during the funeral of Edward II to show his hypocrisy. Brought before a jeering crowd, he was stripped naked and raised on a gibbet by his hands while being read Psalm 52, with the prominent line, "Why do you delight in mischief?" He was then lowered, only to have a noose put about his neck, and then hung until dead. Isabella had begged young Edward for mercy throughout the trial, but the young king ignored his mother and had her banished to Castle Rising in Norfolk. She was forced to give up much of the wealth she had amassed during her regime to the crown. However, Edward would permit her to have enough of a pension as to live out her days in comfort, but under the strict rule that she never again meddle in state politics. Edward III of England was now in his majority and secure in his power as King of England. In his first address as king in 1330, Edward III announced to his court that, "We wish all men to know that henceforth we wish to govern our people according to the right and reason, as befits our royal dignity, and that business which touches us in the state of our realm shall be conducted by common council with the lords of our realm and in no other manner." So, the political atmosphere of the 1300s, and indeed all of Edward III's reign, is that of total feudalism. This is to say that the monarch and his lords were interdependent. They needed each other. Neither was all-powerful. The barons were prone to squabbling amongst themselves, forming leagues and factions, and therefore needed the authority of the king to arbitrate grievances between them and settle disputes. They could not rule by themselves. On the other side, the king had broad theoretical powers. For one, he could go to war as he pleased. However, he needed his earls, barons, and knights to lead and organize his armies. He could halt trade in and out of the country, but needed the consent of merchants or the entire country to tax that trade. He could appoint and remove officials at will, but if they were not respected by the nobility or the clergy, they would not be obeyed. Edward III's success as king came from his ability to rally the nobles of England to his cause and, through them, mobilize the resources of England. The cause in question was one that, to our minds now, having learned everything about the lead-up to these events in the Origins episode, is something that is, well, controversial isn't the right word. It's outrageous. It's truly outrageous is what it is. And it's easy to see why this would cause so much trouble that it would create a conflict that would last 100 years. The great cause of Edward III of England was the claim to the throne of France. For this to even be a thing, we need to step back a minute. King Philip IV of France died in 1328 without a male heir. He did have a daughter, whom we know was Isabella, the wife of Edward II and Edward III's mother. She was the last person born of the House of Capet. Up until now, we've seen almost constant conflict between the Plantagenets and the Capets. From the time of the Norman conquest to the era in question, after 350 years in power, their line was extinguished. There are no more male Capets. Edward III was old King Philip's closest living male relative. He was his grandson. This drove the French court absolutely bonkers, and it's not hard to see why. Think about it. For the past 150 years, we've seen the struggle between the Plantagenets and the Capets tip in favor of the Capets. Through diplomacy and military achievements, they were able to chip away at Plantagenet holdings and annex much of the western French dukedoms that had been under the crown of England. They had been outmaneuvering the English king for years. They had them on the ropes. And now, the new king of England, this young man, was poised to take the entire lot. And not through war, not through political maneuvering, simply through inheritance. The French court would not suffer this. The English sources all imply that what the French did next was essentially a cheap move. Really scraping the bottom of the barrel. In a board game where that one insufferable player pulls some obscure rule out of their ass. That being said, if we look at the French perspective, we see an attempt at protecting the current order, which shouldn't be shocking. If Edward III came to power, it stands to reason that he would relieve much of the French court's primary officials from duty in favor of his own noblemen. Lands would be confiscated and handed out. In essence, the nobility of France would be swept aside in favor of the English ruling class. It would be almost a complete reversal of what William the Conqueror did to the Anglo-Saxon nobility so long ago, almost 300 years before, during his conquest. And so, what the French did in response to Edward's claim was drum up an ancient law from the Frankish period. It was called Salic Law. Salic Law had its roots in the pre-Christian Frankish tradition, and most laws of this period had been discarded or amended by the church because of that influence. In fact, Salic Law, had it still been enforced, would have affected the majority of the French elite by this time in a huge way. Salic Law, as it stated, was that a noble cannot inherit land or titles through their mother's line. It was a flimsy defense, as the nobles of France had been doing so for generations already. After all, the whole reason that the Plantagenets of England were dukes of Aquitaine is because, you'll remember, old King Henry II had inherited it through his mother. Salic Law certainly hadn't been an issue back then. The reason this had a shred of legitimacy is that, technically, Salic Law had never been repealed. It had just stopped being enforced. We can imagine such a thing today. For instance, imagine that tomorrow morning you heard a pounding on the door, and to your shock, it was the police putting you in cuffs over all the songs that you've downloaded in your life. Now you got to go and pay all that back. It would be crazy to imagine something like that, but that's essentially what the French were stating by enforcing this ancient Salic Law all of a sudden. As such, after Philip IV died, the French crown passed not to his grandson, Edward III, but instead to his nephew, another Philip of the French House Valois. The Valois would now be the royal house of France. By defying Edward's claim, well, the young English king, who was only 18 at this time, had all the reason he needed to wage war on France and to press his claim to their throne. The young king now had a cause, and he would rally his entire country behind it. Edward would begin putting this all in motion by using a technique that that world leaders and tyrants have used many times since to great effect. He would create a propaganda machine. Remember that quote I mentioned a moment ago where Edward stated to his parliament that he would rule justly through counsel? Well, he made a similar declaration after announcing his claim to the French throne in 1340. He reiterated the importance of being counseled and upon taking the title of King of France. Quote, "In the affairs of the kingdom, we do not intend to act precipitately or arbitrarily, but holding our will in check, we will be guided by the counsel and advice of the peers, prelates, magnates, and faithful vassals of the kingdom. It shall seem best for the honor of God, the protection and advancement of the church, which we revere in the fullness of devotion, and the furtherance of both the public and private good." So, essentially, he's telling the people of England that they have a voice, and it would be heard, and that all of the king's policies would be in relation to this. He's being a bit of a fox here. He's telling them that they have a voice in one ear, but telling them what their voice needs to say in the other. And this might sound cynical, but it's not entirely. What's closer to the truth is that what Edward is truly doing is shooting two birds with one stone. The people of England had been mismanaged. The kingdom had been economically weak for a long time. Crime was rampant, and the feudal system of the island was far too cliquish. There wasn't much unity. Edward was offering them that unity with his great cause, but also he was showing his people that his great cause would benefit them both in terms of economic power and social power. This propaganda would cross the channel and reach the ears of the Flemish. Now, Flanders had for a long time been an economic powerhouse. Though small and without a huge population, they were great traders and manufacturers. For a long time, they had been under the dominion of France, who hadn't been the best to them. Often the Flemish found conditions under French dominance to be appalling, one-sided, and whenever they protested, were responded to with violence. In addition, England had one export that the Flemish were happy to trade for, wool. The high supply England put out of sheep's wool was abundant enough to satisfy Flanders' demand, who could then resell the wool in the south in exchange for expensive dyes. The combination of the anti-French sentiment, along with Edward's willingness to consult and seek out mutually beneficial outcomes regarding trade, led to Flanders declaring for Edward and supporting his bid for the French crown. Though Edward's main reason for the invasion of France was to claim the throne, there were others as well. Firstly, Scotland and France were united in a pact known as the Auld Alliance, which promised unconditional support between the two nations. This wasn't an enormous issue for England in the past, especially under Edward's grandfather, Edward I, the Longshanks. Scotland had been, for the most part, subjugated. However, with the failures of Edward II and the rebellion of Robert the Bruce, Scotland now had regained much of its land, and the current Scottish King David aggressively raided England's northern borders. These raids were supported by the French, who made similar raids on English coastal towns. Rumors began to spread that France planned to launch a full-scale invasion of England, and if that happened, it was almost guaranteed that the Scots would sweep down from the north as well. By 1337, old King Philip Quépe of France had been dead for a decade. In that time, Edward refused to acknowledge the new king, Philip of Valois. However, he couldn't ignore this Philip for long, for as Duke of a reduced Aquitaine in Gascony, Edward III was Philip's vassal and expected to pay him homage. Remember that word. Philip sent letters to Edward, perhaps purposely antagonizing him, and from Philip's position, England certainly didn't appear that much of a threat. The entire island boasted only a fraction of the population of the whole of France, and, well, France had the finest knights and horses in all of Christendom at this time. War was in the mind of the young Edward, However, he needed time to prepare for his invasion. In that time, there was still some fighting, mostly naval, located in the waters between France and England known as the Channel, or as the French called it, La Manche, which means the sleeve. These minor encounters were nothing more than sparks, yet eventually this little spark would catch, and it would be known as the Battle of Sluys. Preparing for his invasion, Edward gathered ships with the singular desire of choosing a place to make landfall and bring over his army. The problem was that the French navy was far superior than the English was at this time. The French employed galleys, swift, smaller ships that had a low draft and could enter very shallow harbors. They were very versatile. They were versatile enough to switch from oar to sail at speed. Their one weakness, though, was that as smaller craft, they sat low in the water. Edward pressed the merchant ships of England, who were essentially just trading cogs, into his navy. So, again, the name of these ships are cogs. Cogs are enormous, hulking vessels meant for long sea voyages, carrying loads of cargo, and were slower and more cumbersome than these galleys. However, they had the advantage of sitting much higher in the water than a galley, and the strength Edward reinforced of these quags was equipping them with wooden castles at the bow and at the stern of each ship, placing teams of archers high above their foes. Gathering his cogs in July 1340, Edward set out from England, intent on securing a landing for his army in Flanders before marching into France. Anticipating his attempt, the French moved the entirety of their fleet to northern France to intercept. The French leadership, however, did not launch their fleet to meet the approaching English in open water, but instead employed an ancient medieval tactic for defensive naval warfare. They tightly packed their ships together into battle lines, held together by chains. This move would have disastrous consequences for the French, and it appears that its reason for happening was due to inept leadership. An ally of the French, an admiral from the Italian city-state of Genoa, Admiral Barbavera, voiced his concerns to the French commanding officer. By remaining in the battle lines, the galleys would lack any maneuverability against the English archers, sitting high above in their wooden castles. In spite of his experience, though, the French leadership rejected his advice, and so the 204 French warships remain anchored, awaiting the English attack. Edward sent his cogs against the French position in threes, two cogs filled with archers raining missiles down from the wooden castles, and one filled with men-at-arms wielding swords and axes. The French initially scorned the English for using what, to their mind, were old-fashioned projectile weapons, hand-powered recurve bows. The French had used similar weapons almost 300 years ago during William the Conqueror's invasion. They were archaic. Armor had become far more difficult to penetrate since then. The French and allied Genoese archers were armed with new-designed crossbows, which though could not fire as far as a lobbing bow, but maintained more power over a short distance. Feeling confident, the French awaited the English approach. Their error was that the English weren't using just any old hand bow. The English employed the longbow. These tall bows had an immense draw weight, strong enough to put the specialized arrows they used through even the thickest chainmail at as far as 300 yards. Furthermore, English and Welsh archers were so skilled they could easily fire 20 arrows per minute with easy accuracy, whereas the French crossbowmen could merely fire 2 arrows per minute. Utterly unprepared for the barrage from the high wooden castles, the French were decimated. Archer teams would sail up to clusters of French ships, clear the majority of the deck in minutes, with the men-at-arms boarding afterwards, finishing off those aboard and capturing the ships. Once aboard the French ships, the conflict began became like a land battle fought on ships. The French saw their error, for anchored so close together, the English men-at-arms were able to hop from ship to ship, and they swept the decks in the wake of the cogs, bearing the archer squads they were firing down, Mounting at different places, the men-at-arms were able to surround and block in the French soldiers. Chained together, unable to flee, they had no chance for escape. The massacre went on deep into the night, intensifying when the Flemish sent soldiers of their own, intent on paying the French back for years of abuse. There is an account that, unfortunately, we can't verify. However, as a fan of history, especially looking through a romanticized lens, I would love to believe it was true. And so this account in question goes that Edward, having joined his men-at-arms in storming the French boats, came face-to-face with the French commander. Angry, bitter, and aware that his soldiers would be defeated, the French commander threw himself at the king, and the two dueled in the twilight aboard the French galley, with Edward finally getting the upper hand and slaying the French leader by his own hand. The king then announced that his enemy was most noble, and though he had felled his foe, he had taken a wound and was forced to retire. Like I said, there's no way to verify whether or not this is indeed what transpired. All that is recorded after the battle was that Edward III took a wound. By the end of the battle, the entire French navy was utterly destroyed, while the English only lost two ships. Reports claim that the waters around the ships were red with blood and the shallows thick with floating corpses. This first battle is considered to be the opening encounter of the Hundred Years' War. Finally! In the aftermath of the battle, Edward was now able to ferry the rest of his army across the channel to land in Flanders unchallenged. A few setbacks would delay the time of his invasion by several years, as a matter of fact, 5 years altogether. However, the French navy would never recover. In 1345, Edward would successfully land with an army of 15,000 men. The invasion of France had begun. And I think I'm just going to have to stop there for today. Sorry, I know it's a cliffhanger. And I feel that this is a natural feeling ending point for this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Next episode will focus less on historical events and instead take some time to describe how warfare, weapons, army organization, and the like had evolved over the centuries, and what the soldiers of this time and what the war engagements would look like during this period. So this has been the Battle of Agincourt podcast. Thanks for listening.